I'm a passionate region woman because I believe that your geography is not an obstacle to your success.
I'm a passionate regional woman because to me, regional WA is real and raw.
My work gives me the opportunity to travel all over this incredible state and to meet the most amazing people, for which I'm incredibly grateful.
It's all those personalities that make up our diverse communities. It's the people that make here a vibrant place to live.
I believe regional communities cannot achieve economic prosperity without talented regional women living in rural Australia.
It's what makes regional WA the best place to live and love. And that's why I'm a passionate regional woman.
Welcome back to the Triple R Network podcast by Generation Ag. We're your hosts, Kayla Evans and Lavinia Weir. Welcome to our second episode, Vinny.
Hey, Kayla. It's so nice because we're not even living in the same place at the moment. So it's so nice. These are our little mini catch-ups to check in and see how everything's going. It's pretty exciting times.
Yeah, how are you?
I'm going good. I'm thriving still. I'm down in Esperance, working from the town and my dad's farm, having a lot of internet issues. But, you know, I think everyone around the country is suffering the same thing. So I feel like this is going to be good and point out that how important rural connection really is during this time.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's why I'm excited to do this podcast, is because as women, it's a chance for us to stay connected, you and I, but also connect with the community of women in the Triple R network and our own listeners as well.
Absolutely. And we've had an exciting week. We were actually featured in the Farm Weekly for this podcast last week. That was pretty cool, wasn't it?
It was amazing. So sweet of Farm Weekly to, shout out this awesome project we're working on with Triple R Network. Yeah, we think it's important, and it's so amazing to see Farm Weekly agrees with that.
Yes, it was pretty funny. I got home the other night, and because if anyone hasn't seen the article, we have posted it online, but the actual print article, they've taken a lot of the words that I said and they've kind of printed them nice and big, and it was really funny. My dad had it on the front of the fridge the other day, so that was really nice. It's really good to see we've got so many people from different backgrounds, ages, demographics, generations, really excited to hear about all these stories of women doing amazing things in the industry.
Yeah, for sure. And so I guess we'll cover off again, you know, a little bit about Triple R Network. So this podcast goes out to the Triple R Network members, but it also goes out to our regular listeners on our platforms every second Thursday as well. So if you're unfamiliar with Triple R Network and this is your first episode that you're listening to, number one, we'd encourage you to go and listen to last week's episode because it was a juicy meal of an episode at an hour and 15 minutes, but well worth the listen. But the Triple R Network is an amazing place where, you know, women from all areas, rural, regional and remote, can, you know, become part of a community and connect and get involved with issues together. The Triple R Network is passionate about, you know, bringing together like-minded women to develop ideas, connections and become leaders in their own communities. And also the Triple R Network do an amazing job of being a voice on the ground for issues impacting women. So we are just stoked to be on to our second episode.
Absolutely. There are so many phenomenal women in this area, and just to be able to share their stories, yeah, it's pretty amazing opportunity for us.
All right, well, let's jump into our Women of the Week segment. Do you want to go first, Finn?
Well, before I introduce them, I just want to let everyone know, please go, if you have Instagram, go and follow us over at generation.ag, because each second week we will be putting out a call out for amazing women in our industry across all of Australia who are doing phenomenal things. We just want to be lifting women up and celebrating the amazing things they're doing in rural areas. So I'm going to start with number one, which is actually a previous podcast guest of ours, Zoe Hayes. Now, Zoe Hayes runs Dust Off Depression, and Kayla and I were lucky to meet her when we were on the Farmers Across Borders hay run in January. We went up to Laverton and then Meekatharra, which is where she is currently based on a station up there. And Zoe is she was a single mum running or helping run a station up there, and she's actually just gotten engaged, and she's doing really amazing things in rural mental health, and she's such an amazing platform, and she's really real about everything she's experiencing. So if you haven't checked her out, we will link her in our bio. Go and check her out her social medias, and really you'll see how vulnerable she is in front of social. And I think it takes a certain type of person to do that. And we keep getting recommendations for people to interview her. Guys, we've done an interview. We've interviewed her. So if you haven't listened yet, go back track, search Generation Ag Zoe Hayes. It'll probably be one of the first Google items. Click on that and there you go. You've got the podcast episode. And Kayla, you have another Woman of the Week for us?
Yeah, we do. So this recommendation came in from one of our listeners via our Instagram page, and it's for a lady by the name of Courtney Walker. And I've just been doing a bit of research about her the last couple of days, and I just think what she does is amazing. So she is from Limestone Station, and she runs an Instagram page called Little Outback Learners, and that's little.outback.learners on Instagram. And the amazing thing that Courtney does is she runs a play group through School of the Air, which is just so cool. She's trained in early childhood teaching, and the Instagram page is just filled with amazing play ideas for kids, either on stations but also anywhere. And I just think how fun as a mum to be, you know, on a station but also, you know, creating a platform for herself on social media and a business as well, which is just what, you know, this Women of the Week segment was supposed to be all about.
Absolutely. It's really amazing that all over the country, even during COVID, we have some amazing businesses really thriving. And I guess that leads us into today's guest. Now, normally how Kayla and I will do our episodes is that we will all be alternative hosts each week. But because our guest this week, Belinda Lay, is actually based down in Esperance, and so am I at the moment, we thought that because we know we've been doing it for a while, podcast episodes in person are a lot better than trying to do it over the Zoom, don't you think?
Agree, 1,000%. And plus, like, we get a lot out of, you know, meeting all of our guests face to face as well. So anytime we get the chance to sit down over a coffee with our guests, we absolutely take that up.
Yeah, and I got the chance to go to Belinda's farm, and I think it's really interesting when you get to go to somebody's place or their farm, or and you really get to learn a little bit more about them and get a bit more of an in-depth understanding. So that was really special to do that. And I'm really thankful that she invited me into her home, and we had some really good chats that morning. And this is a really good episode for anyone interested in the livestock industry, but even just being a woman who's wanting to advocate for this industry. Yeah, Belinda has a lot of interesting things to say, and it was a very in-depth episode, and I think you'll all really enjoy it.
All right, then we'll let you take it away, Vin.
Belinda is based on a mixed grain and sheep farming enterprise near Esperance, Western Australia, with her husband Dion and their children. Born in Albany in the late 70s, Belinda is the eldest of four children. She grew up in the town of Beverley with her siblings and their mother. Belinda recalls fondly of her grandfather, who played a big role in her life. He didn't see gender, he saw willing and able people. It was her grandfather who taught her she could. And she never imagined women would be treated any differently in agriculture until she was much older. After high school, Belinda moved to Esperance, and in the mid-90s, she worked on S.K. Kidman's property, Ned's Corner, as a gillaroo. It was during this time that she learnt basic stock, water, fencing, shearing and backlining skills. A second year in Esperance and a second job on a cattle property, including a feedlot, early morning mustering and a lot more tractor driving and fencing, as well as chase broom driving for another Esperance family. Belinda has been down here for over 20 years and has accomplished many things. And as her youngest child has become more independent, Belinda decided it was time to take on some challenges of her own, which led her to win the 2019 WA AgriFutures Rural Woman of the Year Award for her innovative project implementing a new network system and importing tracking collars that give real-time data on her sheep any time of the day from any location via her mobile. Her project is based around an Internet of Things, a trial sheep collar, and how data can be collected. Her aspirations are to change the way livestock and technology is viewed, which is mainly concentrated around manual handling. Humans have adopted Fitbits to monitor bodies in real time, and she believes the same thing can be done for livestock. Belinda believes the industry is facing a number of challenges as society's attitudes and perceptions evolve in regards to animal farming and need to be accepted in terms of responsibility to change it. Opportunities in using sensors and movement technologies could be next management tools and take to welfare and lamb survival to the next level. I hope you all enjoy this interview with Belinda. It was an interesting one and she really went in depth about all of her collar technology and how it's evolved over time. And it was a really good experience to go and do an interview in person again because it's been a while. So Belinda, thank you so much for letting me into your home. I'm very excited. We've already chatted for a long time. So let's just get straight into it. Can you talk to me a little bit about your upbringing and your life pre-entering farm?
I moved around a bit when I was a kid. My mum, unfortunately, didn't make some very good choices in her partners, and her second one was quite violent. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in a domestic violence situation for a while, which impacts you and your views for sure. But she eventually escaped that situation. We ended up in a small country town called Beverley and not far away from my grandparents. So from there on, my life was a lot more smooth and enjoyable, I will say. Yeah. It was there and being close to my grandparents, and I used to visit their farm a lot, and so that was where my love of agriculture probably emerged. Mm-hmm. Schooled in Beverley and then had to go to Northam Senior High School for year 11 and 12, and it was there I studied my TE, it was back then. Yeah. And I had five subjects, and my sixth one I picked agriculture. Mm-hmm. Because by this stage at 12, I'd actually decided that I wanted to be like my grandparents. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to marry a farmer, have kids and drive a Land Cruiser. So that was my...
Do you drive a Land Cruiser now?
I do. We got there, no. So they were very young. Yeah. Probably naive dreams, but I guess in town, you know, when I grew up in town, you'd see the farmers' wives and stuff coming in, and I liked the look of their life and what they had and what they're able to do, and you know, I'm sure those farm kids probably envied my life of being in town and able to access all the sport facilities and walk down to the shops for an ice cream and that sort of stuff. But I guess you want what you can't have.
Absolutely. So
that's how that started. I picked as a sixth subject agriculture. Mm-hmm. And at that time, that was in the 90s, early 90s, I was one of the only girls in that class for year 11 and 12, and I did really well. I actually ducked the class.
Amazing.
So I thought, you know, it kind of was fitting in with that 12-year-old girl dream of, you know, educating yourself. I soon discovered that theory is very different to practical farm. I'm very good at farm theory.
But you need both sides.
And then from year 12, I actually, at the end of school, I was going to do a gap year and go to Muresk. Mm-hmm. So I applied for a scholarship into Muresk. Mm. But because of my mum's single parent status, there wasn't the money to go to university straight up. So I knew I was going to have to save or earn my own way in. So missing the scholarship meant that I needed to take a gap year.
Yeah.
So I got a job. I applied for a job out of the newspaper at SK Kidman's property, 100 km west of Esperance, on what was Ned's Corner Station. at that point in time.
The classic, you'd know it if you drive to Esperance, guys, is a big sign.
It's been broken up since then and sold to different farmers in smaller blocks, which is a bit of a shame. But when I was there, it was 25,000 acres.
Yeah, wow.
25,000 sheep, 2,000 head of cattle and a small cropping program.
That's a huge program for back then. That's massive.
Yeah, it was pretty full on.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So, yeah, I managed to get that job. I think it was purely because I was insistent. I kept ringing, asking, you know, have you had a chance to look at them yet? Have you had a chance? Like,
yeah.
I think he just gave in because I was just so...
See what following up does.
But that was a huge shock. My parents had to pack me up. I didn't have a car, so my parents had to pack me up. My mum had remarried actually just before all this happened.
Yeah.
So my mum and my stepdad packed me up, drove me all the way down from Brookton to Esperance, and left me on this 25,000 acre farm. 100 k's from anywhere.
Oh, I bet you were a bit like, what have I done?
No, I loved it.
Oh,
it was great. It was absolutely great. It didn't take me long to get my own car and make myself independent.
Yeah, that's what you need. If you've got independence, you're pretty right.
Yeah, so mind you, I bought myself a dog first. I got a dog first and then a car. So she was my companion.
Classic for country.
About 16 years she was with me, so that was great.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah, so was my first. And I remember that when I first rocked up there, it was shearing time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd done rouseabouting. My uncle was actually a wool classer. Shearing team contractor.
Mm-hmm.
So during my school holidays, I used to go with him rousing on teams. So I was familiar with shearing sheds and sheep. But never had really done much outside of the shed before. So my job was to, at that time, we backline sheep with Eureka Gold. Mm. And so I used to send these yellow sheep out into paddocks. So 25,000 sheep come through the shearing shed and took a couple of weeks to get through
all.
And So that was some of my water runs and fixing fences and changing windmill buckets, just all that hands-on stuff, driving around, checking things. And I probably didn't have as deep a understanding of what the importance of that role by comparison to now. Like I think over time you realise, you know, what it's hard to know which cog you are.
Mm.
I mean, when you're so green like that, which cog you are in the whole big scheme of a mechanism. So, but it was a great hands-on learning experience.
Yeah. And I guess that led you to be in Esperance and on a farm. So can you talk about how you ended up, so you have your own farm with your husband now. Can you talk about how you ended up being on a farm and starting to run your own program?
I'll admit I've done this twice. This is my second husband. My first husband was a farmer as well. I met him when I was 18 playing hockey in town. So a little bit more green and naive back then.
Yeah.
They were 100% cropping farming family.
Mm-hmm.
And it's harder, I think. I don't think I recognised at that point the importance of animals in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And so finding your role in a cropping property where there's no animals and no real way that you can help other than driving a chaser bin at harvest made it really hard. And I think added to that, they were fairly traditional family with traditional roles. And I think naively I thought I'd be able to change that.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the reality. So, So we'll leave that bit there.
Yeah.
But I met Dion playing tennis. So I met my first husband playing hockey and my second husband
sport
playing tennis.
Sport is a factor to find. Love in Esperance.
Well, find them at a pub. That's where they'll always be. So that's my take.
Hot tip.
Anyway. anyway, we digress. Dion here obviously is a mixed enterprise and has the cropping and the sheep and at that time had cattle as well. So was a much, I don't know, personalities fitted, the enterprise fitted, everything just kind of fitted and we still work really well together. So that's been a really good.
Yeah, it seems very cohesive and partnership in all the decisions.
Yeah. So yeah, and he's very open-minded too.
Like
he was not so traditional in what girls should do. So that just opened doors for me to, you know, do the things that I wanted to do and help where I could help. I mean, given that we had, you know, I had small children mm. and, you know, but very flexible and adaptable, and it's just, he's really good.
Yeah, it's awesome. I watched Visible Farmer, which you were on, and, yeah, you could definitely see that relationship there, that he's really keen to see. It doesn't matter if you're female or male, anyone should have the opportunity to be on the farm, which I find really, really commendable, because we're still sort of figuring out those traditional values with new age values, aren't we, on farm?
Yeah, I think Dion just has the attitude of giving people a go, and if they are willing to learn, then he's willing to teach. And I think that's a factor too. I've come to, especially with COVID and having kids at home, really come to recognise that I'm not a teacher.
Yeah.
Not a teacher at all. And I have no tolerance and patience for it, whereas he does. So I think it's maybe a personality thing as yeah. well as, you know, being willing to flex your mind as to what, who can do what.
Absolutely. So that gives you a bit of a, for the listeners, a well-rounded understanding for you and where you've come from. And I want to digress into you being the 2019 AgriFutures Rural Woman of the Year for WA. And I watched the video of you, and you were really surprised that you won. Can you tell us a little bit about the feeling of winning and what this award meant to you?
And I was shocked, yeah, because the other girls are... they had really great projects, and they were, you know, some of them were really quite advanced projects, and they'd gone a long way down the line. And I guess you don't know what judges are looking for, and, mm. you know, what it is, you know, that they want to promote or support. And I guess it's really hard to have someone judge you, like your personality, your ideas mm. and your projects, and that's hard to set. So I really had probably convinced myself that I used to get very nervous when talking to people, and especially yeah. presenting something and public speaking.
Yeah.
So I knew that when I went in and presented my project to the judges, I could hear it in my own voice that I was, you know, you could hear it quaking, and I was just like, oh, they're not going to want that
yeah.
as a public face for, you know, their organisation. Mm. So I kind of had written myself off. So I guess that's why it was such a shock. I was like, oh my gosh, really?
Yeah. But
I guess the benefit of winning is that now I've done a heap of public speaking.
Yeah, I was going to say, you seem like a natural now.
So I still get nervous, but I think it just doesn't come across as much. And they've done a bit of media training and stuff, so they yeah. teach you how to, you know, stick your head between your knees and take some deep breaths. And
yeah.
I think too, having one now, it's kind of a confidence builder that what you're interested in and what you want to look at is actually of value mm-hmm. to the industry. And I think mm-hmm. just that gives you that confidence to pursue it, and then have the confidence to talk about it
yeah.
as well. I mean, when you've got a really left of centre, non-mainstream thought pattern happening,
yeah.
it's not always that easy to be confident about talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's probably one of the big things that's come out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So can you talk a little bit about your project and what's evolved since you've won the award?
Yeah, and a bit of background as well. So my project was it was a pilot project to put a Fitbit, I call it, it's not a Fitbit, but it's a GPS tracking device with an accelerometer and a temperature monitoring sensor in it, to fit them to lambing ewes mm. and see if we could pick up in real time a ewe that is lambing mm-hmm. and may reach some sort of distress or need that human assistance.
Mm.
So, it was just to see if I could, can we do it? It was yeah. basically, can we get this technology? And so the collar technology I brought in from Spain,
yeah.
It was the only one that I'd seen that was commercially available at that time.
Yeah.
there'd been a few newspaper articles and things in the Farm Weekly and the Feedback magazine and things that I'd been reading about different, you know, in Queensland there's an Adjacent's collar for cattle and then there's a Ceres tag that was being developed with CSIRO. And I was reading about all these things when I was sitting here going, well, where are they? Why? I want to play with one. Yeah. Like, give me one. Let me put this out there and let's start, you know. Does it work? Is it of any use? Mm-hmm. Like, or is it all just hype? I guess was the thing. So I ended up having to you may have to turn my two-way. Sorry. The old two-way, but just turn that one. Yeah, thanks. Sorry. So I found one online. I just Googled, researched online. Okay.
Yeah.
And found one based in Spain. And I emailed the company and just, you know, explained where I was and what I wanted to do and why I wanted to do it. And it took them a while to respond, actually. And I guess I sit here in hindsight wondering if they actually needed to translate my email. Yeah. It was like being Spanish. So, they emailed me back and told me, you know, what I needed to do, like, and how, what connectivity I needed. And that was another piece altogether because it runs off something called Sigfox.
Yep.
So Sigfox is an equivalent to LoRa. Mm-hmm. It works on that same IoT radio frequency band. Mm-hmm. Difference being that LoRa, if a farmer was to install a LoRa station, they have to buy that tower.
Okay.
And it's theirs. And then if something happens to it, it's their problem.
Their problem, yeah.
Sigfox works slightly different, similar, except that the Sigfox tower remains the property of Sigfox. Mm-hmm. And so it's a bit like a Telstra tower, like the Telstra tower belongs to Telstra and they charge you a rental. Mm-hmm. And then if something happens to the Telstra tower, then it's Telstra's problem. Mm-hmm. So Sigfox runs on the same kind of business model.
Yeah.
So that to me was a little more attractive because if lightning hit it,
I was like, wouldn't be your problem.
Not my problem. So I actually contacted Sigfox, and Sigfox is quite new to Australia. It's actually not, it's spread quite comprehensively through Europe.
Okay.
Obviously, that fits with the Spanish development because they have Sigfox towers everywhere and it works for them. So it's been kind of spreading around the South Pacific Asia area and New Zealand. Actually, New Zealand is quite comprehensively covered by Sigfox, but Australia not so much. Mm-hmm. So it's been deployed over the last two or so years around all the major capital cities.
Yeah.
And they use it to track things like airport bag carriers and things like that, like asset. It's basically an asset tracker.
Yeah, okay.
So anything that you, so car fleets, anything that you want to keep tabs of, where they, where is this, where's it gone, like, you know, where are my assets? So that's why it's used very heavily in cities, people just tracking their assets around the place. So I contacted them and just said, look, I want to bring a technology in on the farm. It runs on Sigfox. How can I, can we organise, or, you know, how do I get one of your towers out here into the middle of nowhere to run a trial on 100 sheep.
Yeah.
And that was...
how receptive were they to that?
They're not too bad, actually. Yeah, that's good. So they had a consultant that they were working with in Perth. He came down with a couple of his mates. They sat around here on the kitchen table and we had a massive chat about all the potential things that we might want to track using a Sigfox connectivity. Obviously, I sold it pretty well to him because he went back and within about 6 weeks there was a tower up on the neighbour's hills. So that,
That doesn't happen a lot here in Esperance, so that's good, quick work.
Oh, there was a bit of a process leading up to that, but once the final decision was made, it didn't take long at all.
That's
was...
awesome. And then since then you've been using the tower with the collars to track your sheep.
Yeah, so I used it. I did my first trial, my pilot trial for Rural Women's Ward last year. And from that I've actually submitted and have a 3-year trial running. So based on the things that I learnt and saw in my pilot trial, reformulated it, rejigged it, added some bits, and now running that for 3 years, starting this year. So that's been interesting journey.
Yeah, and looking so far, it's been obviously really rewarding and really interesting results.
Interesting, maybe. And maybe I'm just, I mean, I don't know. There's potential return on investment for it, but I think a lot of it's just a little bit curiosity of, you know, so we just, I've just had the data, last year's data sent to Murdoch University, mm-hmm. and a lecturer up there, Helena Cobran, has been mapping the data onto in a GIS program, mm-hmm. and actually showing us where the sheep were, concentrations, their preference to water troughs over a dam, mm. you know, all that sort of just that interesting stuff.
All the data and stats put together.
And going through and seeing if through the data we can pick up the actual day that they gave birth. And mapping that. And so a lot of sideline curiosity, is there like a maternity ward within a paddock? Like, mm-hmm. is there a one spot that they go to give birth, and what is it about that spot?
You know,
so
this is all data we've never really taken before at all, really. Have we in Australia much? Or
I dare say there's possibly been some quiet, you know, trials and stuff, but like I was saying, it's a little bit curiosity rather than a return on investment. So when there's not commercial value, they just don't make it out into the
background. But you're saying though there could be the potential for return on investment. Is that correct?
I think so. If you can pick up, you know, so we kind of know how long it takes for a ewe to give birth.
Mm.
We know how long it takes for a ewe to bond with a lamb.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can track like behaviour and movement over a time period and see, you know, and pick up that moment when activity drops that indicates that lambing is imminent, but then that you who's displayed that behavior gets up and just starts moving around the paddock again, you're like, what happened there? Like, was the lamb dead? Did it not, you know, is it stuck and she's just walking around?
Which happens.
It does. So I think you know, and I heard this recently and I agree, is the sheep values at the moment are quite high. And should you, now I'm trying to work out how it went, it was, why are we still managing a 21st century industry using 1980s management methods? And I just went,
wholeheartedly agree with that.
and I do too. So, I mean, we've got these advancements in technology that are becoming available to us. You know,
especially when you put like cropping versus livestock, the advancements in technology and cropping versus livestock, you'd think, why aren't we doing it on the same level? For sure.
And that was definitely one of my thoughts, which, you know, because I mean, and I think I was thinking about it because the tractor was probably seeding here that year in this paddock right here. And it was like, you can 2-centimetre auto steer that thing within inches of the fence.
Yeah.
But we can't tell if a ewe has got a lamb stuck. So, and I guess the other part too here on the farm is that we've started to do something called crop grazing, where you put your crops in early, get them established, and then you use them as a pasture for the sheep. And then come, you know, August, when, you know, the crop starts putting up its, you know, leaf, its wheat or barley starts putting up its flag leaf, then you pull your sheep off.
Yeah.
And you let it finish and then you harvest it.
Yeah.
So I guess this is moving into the more modern, or not modern, but the current way of thinking, you know, when you think about climate change, wise water uses, and I guess too, animal activism, and that was another part that kind of added to my thinking, was the big protests that started happening over live export.
Yeah.
And I sort of started thinking, you know, I get a lot of the industry, and I get it, I understand, like when people come at you and start attacking what you do, you get defensive, which is kind of how I felt the industry reacted
to
that protest. But I kind of sat back and just went, okay, I could see why everyone's getting defensive, and that's fine. But you can't just dig your heels in and say, no, this is the way it's done because it's the way it's always been done.
Yeah.
And do we as an industry need to challenge ourselves as to what we could actually do better?
Mm.
And I guess that's where my thinking went. Mm-hmm. So then, you know, so tying in with all this discovering of technologies and, you know, so I just went, you know what, if the technologies can help us do it better and also help us to illustrate how we're doing it better mm-hmm. to the public,
mm.
it's worth a look.
Yeah.
Like that was my thinking.
I definitely agree, and I think we as farmers need to put our brains together and think of ways to do things better for a 21st century way of thinking.
And I guess, you know, you talk about return on investment, but, you know, sometimes people think of return on investments by way of a financial return
mm.
or a time return, like time saver.
Yeah.
But we don't really think about social license
as welfare as well. Yeah.
So that's very, and animal welfare has become a very big focus of mine in that wanting to do things better.
Mm.
'Cause I think we can, and not, I think as an industry, we can do it because we can,
mm.
not because some activists tell us we should.
Mm.
You know, I'd rather be proactive than reactive. Mm. I guess that's my, you know, how can we be proactive about this?
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, once COVID goes away and that everything, if it ever returns to normal, you know, those people that had those concerns about operations are still there.
Mm.
They're not going to go away.
No.
They're not going to stop protesting against what we do. So mm. I kind of see we've kind of been given some leeway in this short period of time to actually become proactive
mm.
and start, you know, creating some conversations within the industry of what can we do
mm.
and meet them. I don't want to go all the way their way at all.
Yeah.
It's got to be practical. Yeah. It's got to be, you know, sustainable.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we can shift.
Yeah.
I'm certain we can shift.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a lot that can be done to make sure that we're producing meat that's ethical and that we make sure that we're actually looking after our livestock to the best of our ability, which most people are. But yeah, there's still more that can be done for sure.
Absolutely, yeah.
So can you talk a little bit more in depth about your trials? Can we know some numbers, sort of how many sheep, what variety, what's happening, where are they? Can you give me all the stats, give me what's going on?
My next trial started. So I actually started at joining time this year. Mm-hmm. So I didn't start till just before lambing last year, I put the sensors on.
Yeah.
So this year I put them on at joining, so when mm-hmm. the rams went in, and I used a Bluetooth device.
Yeah, okay.
And what I was chasing was an actual joining date. So mm-hmm. what I found difficult with my trial before is, with my pilot trial, was picking up that lambing behaviour was kind of had to be observational,
mm-hmm.
And of course the data that was coming through on my phone was only available for 24 hours, so I was spending a lot of time and a lot of effort, and I just thought this would be so much easier if I knew when each ewe was actually due to drop their lamb.
Yeah.
Then I can watch that particular ewe
yep.
at that time rather than the whole lot yeah. all the time and trying it. So these are the things you learn when you do a yep. pilot trial, which yep. is why it got refined. But this year I've tried a lot of what I've been trying to do is work out what technologies can do what I want it to do.
Mm. So manipulate it a little bit.
Help myself out. Yeah. So it was basically seeing if these Bluetooth technologies could tell me when the ram was in proximity to the ewe, which would give me an estimated joining day, and whether that would then tell me when she was due at the other end, and then I could monitor and follow that through,
yeah.
and then I can compare like the data that's coming through from the collars
yeah.
compared to what's actually happening and watching who I need to watch, not everybody. And
how many are you have set up with collars at one time?
Yeah, so the interesting thing about all this, which I didn't know when I first won my award, is research like this and actually has to go through an animal ethics committee. Yeah, yeah, so I, that was a bit of a, a bit of a steep learning curve.
Yep.
So because I wanted, well, because of the award and the requirement to speak publicly about what you're doing means you have to have an animal ethics approval to run your trial in the first place. So that was something I had to do and quite quickly, which I was granted, which is, So obviously to put in something like that, you have to set what you do. Yeah. I only bought 100 collars, so the number maximum number of sheep I can run it on at this point in time is 100 sheep.
Yeah.
So I had 100 in my adjoining trial. Obviously as we preg scan, so obviously some of them weren't successfully mated, so they've now exited the trial. So I think I'm down to 92.
That's still pretty good percentage wise. Or would you prefer 100?
Oh, you know, I've come to compare sheep to humans, and you know, not every time a human tries to get pregnant are they successful.
Absolutely.
So, sheep are the same. So, no, as long as what comes through the other end, I'm more worried about the other end. Like once they're pregnant, like getting that lamb safely on the ground and to a weanable age. That's where the rubber hits the road, I suppose.
And I guess this year now, after the pilot trial, you worked out all how you're going. This will be kind of a critical year, do you think?
The whole idea of the trials is actually to see, and this has been the interesting discovery of my whole trial, is how technology actually, where it's at. And, you know, there's some great ideas out there and there's some great concepts out there. But when it comes to practical application and the collection of data and then streamlining that data and integrating it with other data sets, that's a whole different minefield. And that wasn't what I was expecting from this trial. I kind of, I think, again, I came in rather naively that all these ag technologies were like tried and tested and proven, and like by the time they hit the market, they're like good to go. That is not the reality. It's really not. I've kind of had to learn a whole other section in regards to the technologies themselves. And really come to understand the infancy of ag tech in Australia and the troubleshooting and what's going on and where things are at. But at the same time, I've embraced that and said, well, actually, this is my opportunity to help influence this industry while it's in its infancy. And kind of push to ensure that what's best in the best interest of the farmers rather than, I guess I come at it from that angle, rather than what's in the best interest of the tech company, there's a very big gap.
Absolutely. I mean, we would know that both from going to Evoke, seeing the gap between there's amazing ag tech out there, but it's just not being responded well to the farmer because there's no communication between. So I think you're kind of in a great position to advocate for both sides so there can be some sort of good positive collaboration.
And it's, I guess it's trying to understand both sides, and I probably don't fully understand the ag tech. I think this is just my opinion, but the business model doesn't really fit super well with the farming business model. And I say that with a bit of a reserve because there's some there's some things you can't avoid, but some, you know, there's some things you can. So, like, I'll use my, you know, I'm not the hugest fan of the subscription model, and my reason for that is that it's something that comes out of a farm budget, regardless of how much it's been utilized or how much benefit it's provided a farmer. It comes out, and I get it that the ag, like the tech company, needs that
steady income stream. But from a from my perspective as a farmer, I'm so used to, say, I need a new tractor. I go and I buy the tractor and it's mine and I do what I want with it.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, of course there's follow-up costs, but it's based on how much I use it.
Yeah.
So if I don't use it and it sits in the shed, I don't need to service it.
Yeah.
Whereas if I sign up for something with a subscription and I don't use it,
the money's
still
going
have to pay
yeah.
for it.
Yeah.
So it kind of... That's my personal conflict with
it. I think that's interesting. You're not the only farmer in the region that's actually brought this topic up recently. There are a few people talking about the value, if you are going to have some sort of technology on your farm, is a subscription the actual best way to go about it? Or, you know, because you don't know if it's going to be viable for your business until you start using it, really. There's only so many trials that you can decide whether it's going to work before you actually trial it yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's so many different ways to connect too. I mean, you've got 3G, 4G, now 5G. You've got Sigfox, you've got LoRa, and then there's Bluetooth, and it's a real minefield on working out which one's going to work for you.
Yeah.
And then, you know, of the things that I want to put on farm, are they available all through the same method of connectivity or does, you know, one need a satellite? Well, there's one I didn't mention before, satellite.
Yeah.
So, you know, this technology needs, you know, Sigfox or LoRa, and this one needs satellite, and this one, it's really interesting.
It's very complicated.
So I've seen some tools and workshops lately being developed, which I think will be very useful once they've been refined. That's coming out of the Farmers to Founders group. So I think that'll make things easier for farmers to navigate that space, but they're still working on that.
Yeah, a lot of trial and error still going on, isn't there?
There is.
Probably we shouldn't be dealing with it in 2020, but...
Oh,
particularly when I talk about the satellite NBN.
Oh, we're not on NBN here, so I haven't had to worry about that beast. But I've stuck with the old mobile broadband, so we just stick to it. Yeah, lucky I have a tower nearby, so that makes that a viable option for us.
Yeah, definitely.
But again, cost. You know, there's cost. So you know, some people go, oh, yeah, but you have a subscription on your accounting package and you have... And I was like, yeah, I do. And some of those are unavoidable.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of those things you actually have to do for your business to keep running.
Yeah, so it's interesting. But we seem to be all moving to this, you know, this subscription-based model with this magical cloud. Which I love the word cloud because it kind of just sounds, you know, like it's got a silver lining and a rainbow and unicorns flying. I mean, rather than the big reality, which is a big industrial shed with all these packages in it and climate control and they're not as pretty as a cloud sounds.
Yeah.
But I also have questions about those and I said something we haven't really, and I think Evoke didn't really address either, and I hope they do, and that's actually data ownership. Because data ownership is another aspect of what I've come to understand about what I've been doing.
Yeah, I think AgTech Finders are sort of trying to do a little bit of stuff around that, but it's still a very unknown space and everyone's still a bit unsure about who actually does own a lot of the, you know, are you the owner of your data with your sheep technology or is the collar people owning it?
And I can answer that. And technically they do.
Yeah.
Although they say I do.
Okay.
So,
which makes it complicated.
Well, and that was part of, and I guess this is raised for me from personal experience. So when I bought the collars, it came with an app on my phone and the data goes from the collars to my Sigfox tower, goes up into one of those magical, mystical clouds.
Yep.
They run their algorithms and logistics over it.
Yeah.
And then the alerts and the tracking and the GIS maps come up on my phone. And that's how I was being alerted to what was going on. And I was able to look at 24 hours of data. And then after that, it was gone.
Yeah.
I couldn't.
Which is very interesting to know that.
But... So historically, I couldn't get hold of, you know, if I wanted to compare this 24-hour block with a 24-hour block last week, I couldn't do it.
And have they made implementations and changes?
Look, I've since, not on the app.
Okay.
But it took me 6 months to get my raw data from that company into my own zip file.
Yeah.
And then I kind of discovered that once it's in a zip file, it's in a CSV with all these columns and a whole heap of stuff. And I was like, it's not actually usable.
Yeah.
Like, which is why I think some of these tech companies go, well, it's, you know, you don't, you couldn't do anything with it anyway, so you don't need it. And but I disagree with that.
I do too. Yeah. I think there's, how can there be, you know, a real premise for you really wanting to utilize these collars further down the track if you're not going to be able to have the usable data that you understand to be able to implement into your program and actually, you know, have a positive outcome? And that is definitely part of the reason why ag tech and the disconnect is there, because they're not transitioning and remembering. Not every farmer is a scientist, like we talked about earlier, and you've got to have data that can be understood by the average person.
Yeah, and the other thing, like this trial this year, I have a handful of ewes that were in last year's trial. Mm-hmm. So the ability to compare their lambing behaviour or lead up this year compared to how they behaved last year is an important part of what I'd like to look at.
Yeah.
So, being able to get hold of that. So that really has raised that aspect for me and I've kind of dug very deeply into that.
Mm.
And I guess I have the question, let's use that collar data that scenario that I was saying.
Mm.
When that piece of data from the collar leaves my farm and goes to the tower and hits up in their cloud, at that point it gets recorded with a time date stamp in their cloud.
Yeah.
So if I was to have a disagreement with them and want my data and they didn't want to give it to me and I tried to take it to court, who has the evidence of the recorded piece of data with a time date stamp?
They do.
So where does that leave the farmer?
Yeah.
And I know it hasn't happened, and if it has happened, then I haven't heard about it.
Yeah.
And I'd be very curious if anyone's actually had an experience like that and how it ended, because the way I see it, that's the way it is. So although they give us access to it, is it really ours? So I've actually been doing a pilot trial with another company recently.
Yeah, okay.
In this data space.
Yeah, and they give you full ownership.
They do.
Yeah,
so their data is put up into the tower, goes into through a messaging program.
Yeah, okay.
Which unifies the data, which makes it easier to cross data over as well, because it's all written the same way. And then it goes into a database that is owned by me.
Oh, awesome.
So it's my storage space.
Yeah.
And then from there, the idea is that the company, so it's actually the company I've been working with for my, I've since put in water tank sensors and a weather station that all run off the Sigfox.
Yeah.
So and they've worked with me on this, which is great. They're very much part of this pilot trial because we kind of have similar views, and I approached them with my views on this data ownership. So then the idea is that they would plug in to my database and draw the data back out and display it to me on their platform.
Yeah, okay.
So everything goes through my database first. I have the first time date stamp on it.
Yeah.
And then they plug into it and display it to
and
me.
And is that through an app that you get all that information?
A platform, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Awesome. So that's really cool.
So it's just changing that dynamic of who actually, I mean, I still bought the devices from them.
Yeah.
I still have a subscription. I do pay a subscription to them for the, and then, but the data I know is secure in my database, and then they API out of that and display it to me. So I think that changes it changes things, because now what I'll do, like with other things other companies, I'll be asking them to put the data through my database so that it's mine, and then they plug into mine. And that's how it'll be. And if they're not willing to do that, then we won't be doing business. That's just how it is.
Yeah, which is absolutely your right to say that.
But what it does too is allows you to cross over your data too, is cross over my, because it's all been coded universally, like in the same way.
Yeah.
You can layer stuff in different ways that other people may not be able to layer it.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
I can start maybe crossing over my cropping data with my sheep data and see how they interact.
Yeah.
What's affecting what.
And absolutely.
So it's an exciting, exciting thing to be in.
It can change the way you guys do your whole program.
It's well, fingers crossed, touch wood. The next piece.
Well, I think we've talked fairly in depth. It's really interesting to hear from your perspective, really, because I don't think you've had the chance to talk in an open forum like this so in depth. So I think a lot of people will get a lot out of hearing what you've got to say. So with that, I want to talk a little bit about the Triple R Network, because that's a big part of what you've done. And so can you elaborate on your time with the Triple R Network, how you've been a part of the Triple R Network and what they're doing now?
Yeah, my interaction with the Triple R Network is probably only recent compared to some people. They first kind of stumbled across my radar, partly because of the Rural Women's Award. No, it would have been before that, sorry. we're going to go way off track from ag tech here, aren't we?
Changing lanes.
Changing lanes. A few years ago, there was an incident that happened with a friend of mine. And I got really upset with the way she was treated. She was an ag-based advisor or consultant or whatever you want to call her. And something happened, and she tried to raise it with management that, you know, this person wasn't being overly nice. The end result was the company fired her. She lost her job. And that, I don't know, it probably combined with my whole 20 years on farming and my experiences and, you know, being a Jillaroo, I had some experiences of my own. And I don't know, I end up calling, I've labelled it the year I burnt my bar. So, I ended up raising it with Triple R because I was trying to kind of bring awareness to this kind of behaviour in the industry and what some people were experiencing.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel like I was being heard. So I reached out to the Triple R Network and said, hey, this is something that I've witnessed. It's something I've experienced. Is there something we can do? Now, at the time, I didn't know that there was similar stuff going down in another avenue.
Within,
Within. So the two kind of collided at the same time. And I'm very grateful to the Triple R. They actually kind of really picked up the voice and made it heard on females' experiences in agriculture. So that was probably the first time I interacted with them. I joined up as a member.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I won the Rural Women's Award, which is the Triple R Network run the event for that. So went to their Stronger conference last year, which was really good. That was a really empowering event, and the networking is fantastic. And they're just a really supportive network.
Yeah. Do you feel that these are the type of women that are, you know, the ones that are going to create the change? So it's good to be around the like-minded women.
I think everybody has the opportunity to make change if they really want to.
Yeah.
I don't think that you have to be in a particular group to do that. But they're definitely, you know, there's some movers and shakers in there.
Yep. And what was it about the Stronger conference that really stood out to you by attending?
That you're not actually alone. That there are lots of women out there with lots of ideas and very different perspective, and you can learn from all of them, I think. And that was the, you know, no one person can achieve everything.
Mm,
so absolutely. To be in a room of people that are all kind of chewing away at their little bit, you can kind of see that combined there's really that very big potential to achieve something greater.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a very it's very empowering to be around movers and shakers.
Yeah, I think you definitely feel when you are in a room like that, you feel really energized after leaving, don't you? You feel like you've got other people that are on your side, which is exciting.
Yeah, yeah, and just the diversity of what they're tackling.
Yeah.
And the subjects, and some of them you've never even thought of.
Mm.
And yeah. But they're in there.
Yeah, so. It's really good. It's very nice to have a group like this for sure. I want to talk a little bit about 2020 and COVID and other stuff going on your farm, because everyone's had a little bit of a shake up with how things are running. So can you talk about what's been happening on the farm since COVID and what are the other stuff you've got going on other than the sheep collars?
COVID's been interesting.
Yeah.
When COVID hit, actually, I was in Perth doing the AICD full company director's course. So I came home like basically on the cusp of when they just started shutting everything down.
Mm-hmm.
So I only made it home just.
Yeah.
Which was actually my birthday, and I called through my friend's place actually. On the way home, and she said, "Oh, happy birthday!" And she gave me a 12-pack of toilet paper, and I went, "What do I want that for?" So, and she goes, "Oh, you just never know." And then when I got back to Esperance, there wasn't a roll of toilet paper on the shelf anywhere, and wasn't for weeks.
Yeah.
And you know, you're fairly well stocked in these things on the farm anyway, but
yeah.
I ended up having to dip into that 12 pack of toilet paper, so it was actually the best present ever. So that was that. So I came home to having to, I mean, we had our workers here. We do a clay spreading program over summer, so we had staff that we were planning to tie over for seeding anyway. But having to sort of look at COVID and how that affects the staff and how we were managing staff and you know, trying to get hold of hand sanitizer and baby wipes to wipe tractor.
Yeah, because at that point no one really knew what was going to happen. It was very early days and everyone was a bit unsure about if, you know, it was going to be a huge outbreak or if it was going to sort of get down to where it is now, and we didn't know anything.
No, and I think everyone kind of went overly cautious. I mean, which was great.
I mean,
you needed to.
You had to. You had no choice.
So we basically chose to lock the farm down. No one was to go to town except one person, which was me. And we hired, my daughter was in town as working in a cafe, and she obviously lost her job. So we employed her as a personal shopper. And she was, so the staff would send her their shopping lists. She would go and do their shopping. She'd drive it out to the farm and drop it off, basically. And that just was how we kind of helped her and managed the staff requirements. On a trial level, I actually had to submit a form to the animal ethics on how I was going to be able to maintain the monitoring and of the sheep during a trial, and what was it going to be impacted, and is there a potential for the sheep's, you know, welfare to be jeopardised. Which I guess luckily compared to a lot of researchers, and I guess this has been emerging in the news in the last week or so, is the impact of COVID on research.
Yeah.
And I hadn't really thought about it. And I guess I'm lucky because I live on site.
Yeah.
So I can monitor my trials and my research because I'm here.
Yeah.
And, you know, our policy was to shut the farm down. So there was no impact to my trial. It's been able to go forward as per normal. But, you know, it really made me realise that, you know, the people that work maybe for the ag department or in other research facilities that are coming and coming and going from that facility may have had to, and I think, you know, when I saw the replies back to the Animal Ethics Committee from other people, like quite a few people had to shut their trials down and cease or defer them.
So you really lucky.
I know. You'd really do start to recognise how fortunate we are.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, that was it. And in other – I did have a bit of a probably about 3 weeks in, I kind of had a bit of a low because I come to recognise that I really relied on my town days for that social interaction that I like to have with people.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's no cafes open. No. You can't, you know, you weren't allowed to be in a group greater than two. So the ability to go and catch up with your friends and have a coffee or go out for lunch was eliminated. So your town days were reduced to into town, get the mail, buy your newspapers, do your shopping, get out.
Yeah.
Basically.
And even still, I think for the listeners, Esperance is still pretty shut down. Like, we haven't got – majority of our cafes are still completely closed and we're in the stage two now. So it's – yeah, people are getting – it's pretty tough, especially because we're already very isolated here anyway. So, yeah, it does make it really hard.
Yeah, and I think too off the back of – and I do wonder too if that three-week thing was, you know – as the new I handed on the baton of the Rural Women's Award to Cara.
Yeah.
And so I also wonder if it was kind of the whew, at the end of a big year, like where this kind of
you're just a bit exhausted. Yeah.
I do kind of wonder if there's a bit of correlation with that.
Yeah.
And since I have to say I've actually loved because I was gatting around everybody last year.
I was going to say, you were. You've been jet setting. You haven't been home.
Not really. And I mean, my husband and I even took up the opportunity to, I got asked to speak at an AgTech conference in Amsterdam. Mm. So, I mean, my husband and I went to Europe as part of my award year and, you know, went to Spain and met the manufacturers of collars. Yeah. And then I went to Evoque and I went, you know, and I was asked to speak at three or four different things. Like, I was everywhere last year. And it was actually been really nice to just stay home. And I was sharing with you earlier, this house was partially, well, we extended it over 10 years ago. And, you know, what happens on farms sometimes is the budget runs out and it never quite gets finished and you run out of time. And, and
other things are more important.
And then you go, ah, it's livable, don't worry about it, and you move in. So that's kind of what happened. But, you know. COVID's had, you know, we've had a few tins of paint pulled out and some things have been finished and, you know, the house
all those projects you wanted to do but never got around to.
So the house is starting to look a little schmick, like someone likes it.
It's hard when you're away and you've just got so much on the go.
Yeah, and I'm not someone that actually just does the bare basics either, I don't think. I'm kind of an all-in kind of, I'm an all or nothing kind of person. So, you know, I'm in this space and I'm looking at this stuff, so I'm looking at everything, not just you know it's extended from, you know, it started as these trials, but, you know, now I've tried a different collar technology and like I was saying, I've now put in a weather station.
Yeah,
I've put
you're in doing
tank
lots.
Monitors and you know, in my head there's automatic gates and I don't know if at Evoque you saw that swarm farm robot.
But that's interesting.
And I was like, oh, I want one of those. Like, how can I get one of those on farm?
Yeah,
because it's basically a robot that you can hook up a boom to and it's autonomous.
Oh, I have seen them
and I was like, oh, it can spray by itself, and then I'm automatically jumping going, can it feed sheep by itself? Like, does it how does it open gates? We need to work out here. So my brain's constantly ticking over, how can we do this, how can we do that? And I kind of have set myself this thing now of success will look like when I can sit in the back patio with my laptop, in my pajamas, drinking coffee, and I can move sheep. That will be.
I love that.
That's the vision. So basically, I'm just basically going through the motions.
Can't wait to see this.
What do I need?
Yeah.
What connectivity do I need? What's the best device?
Yeah.
How do we make this work?
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's so many elements to moving them up a sheep.
Oh.
But to be able to do it from my back patio.
Especially if you're considering ever moving wind lambs, a whole nother ball game.
Ah, absolutely. But, you know, so it's just that whole process. But that is like, I'd like to be sitting here in 10, 15 years' time being able to say, I've done it. I can do it. Wow.
Yeah, incredible. Well, I can't wait to see it. We'd definitely have to get that for sure. And before we go, because we better wrap it up, can you tell people where they can find you and how can they get in touch if they want or have more questions for you?
Probably Twitter. I'm a big Twitter user.
And you have a really good website as well, don't you, for the farm?
I do, yeah. It probably needs an update because there's some of those. So that's www.coolanddown.com.au.
Yeah.
On Twitter, it's at techyouup. With the sheep you like
but also when you search that you'll see Belinda's name as well, that'll come up with it. Awesome, thank you so much for your time. It's been amazing to chat. I've learned so much. I think it's definitely we'd love to keep up to date with the trials and what's happening with the sheep collars and all the data collection. I think that's really important.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Triple R Network podcast by Generation Ag. Stay tuned for another episode in this series in a fortnight's time.